red shoes.
What's the matter, Morty?
Moral, the thing.
Tension by our whole dress.
Moral, the thing.
Great gowns.
Moral,
beautiful gowns.
Fashion has changed.
Moral,
no, it hasn't.
Hi, I'm Lauren Garoni.
And I'm Chelsea Fairless. And welcome to the Every Outfit podcast. This has been the longest week imaginable, has it not?
It has indeed. I think we've lived several months just in this past week.
Yeah, I feel like I was a different person when we recorded last week's episode.
Yeah, should we get into the circumstances of recording last week's episode? Because we were a tad cavalier when we recorded last Wednesday morning. Having lived in Los Angeles basically my entire life, there have been a lot of fires. You are used to the areas where these fires happen in. They do not interact with the city the way that this fire has.
Yes, this fire was extra fucked.
And I even said Wednesday morning, I was like, unless a spontaneous fire starts in Laurel Canyon, like, I'm good. And then lo and behold, a fire started in Runyon Canyon.
Do we know how that one started, though?
We do not. I'm sure there's going to be many congressional hearings about this.
Well, that one was extra fucked because you actually were in an evacuation zone. You got the scary, like, Amber Alert text.
You and I were in a back and forth about if we even needed to re-record our intro to our podcast. And as we were having this text exchange, I was seeing on my new favorite Twitter account, LA Scanner, that a fire had started at Runyon. And then streets started to get closed off. That's when I freaked out. I didn't genuinely think it would get to where Paul and I live, but the idea of living in a hillside and everyone having to evacuate at once and the panic that that causes was like, okay, we gotta go.
No, of course. And that spooked me too. I wasn't in an evacuation zone. I was in a red flag warning zone because there's three levels, right? For people that don't live in Los Angeles, there's the red flag warning. There's the evacuation warning, which means pack your shit, be ready to go at a moment's notice. And then there's the mandatory evacuation, which is what Lauren got. But even with a red flag warning, I got spooked because the Palisades fire is on one side of me, then the Runyon fire on the other side of me, then those random houses in Studio City just started burning, and I was like, I just need to be inland. So how long did it take you to get out of your house once you got the mandatory evacuation alert?
12 minutes.
Wow.
Yeah. So it's safe to say that I packed a random assortment of things. I did pack the important things. That wasn't a joke in last week's episode. I did pack up the J.W. Anderson pigeon bag, but I did forget the Every Outfit award. It was too heavy. It was going to have to get lost.
Lauren, do not take that. I can spend another $100 at like promotionalawards.com to replace that.
I didn't take my wedding dress, but I took Paul's tabbies that he wore to our wedding.
But it's crazy what your brain does in that situation. Because when I got to the point where I was like, I just want to get out of here now, I grabbed really random shit too. You know, a portrait of my dog, my dog's ashes, Isabelle Huppert's seat card that Tat retrieved from the Balenciaga Couture show, that hoodie that Steven made me for my 40th, just like the most random stuff. I didn't really take any clothes.
I will say I did have the presence of mind to grab our podcast hard drives. So the drives that have every episode of our podcast. This is the Rosetta Stone.
Oh my God. But it's weird because when you're in a situation like that, I almost got like conflicting spiritual messages. Because on one hand, you realize like the only thing that really matters is our physical safety, right? Am I okay? Is my family okay? Is my dog okay? That's number one. And then you kind of realize that the things you actually do care about are the things that are sort of imbued with either like your personal history or things that remind you of someone else. And then the third wave of that is the realization like, fuck, like what if I lost all of this stuff? It's so fucking heartbreaking.
we're not really suited for this kind of crisis, because when we try to be genuine with our monotone voices, I fear it doesn't come off that way.
It definitely doesn't come off that way. And obviously with the podcast, we're always trying to distract people and not get into the hard issues and not get into our feelings and stuff like that. But it's hard not to feel despair on some level.
But then there are also these micro moments that I don't know if they're breaking containment outside of Los Angeles that are just bizarrely funny. Like, I don't know if you saw the clip of Dennis Quaid discussing that his agent lost both his houses. And it was like, not now, Dennis. Did you have to say he lost both his houses?
Yeah, that's bad. Although we got a heroic moment from Steve Guttenberg, who helped people escape the Palisades fire, which is really cool. I've always fucked with him, obviously, because of Three Men and a Baby. So good for him.
Should we talk about our new favorite app? Move over TikTok, because everyone in LA is obsessed with an app called Watch Duty.
Yeah, I think I've spent more time on Watch Duty than Instagram this week.
So for people who are unaware of what this app is, it is a user-generated app that in real time updates a map of California with the fires. And the fact that this isn't funded by our government, that it is just a person sitting in their underwear for all we know, that is just like living off Red Bull and Monster Energy drinks, updating in real time where these fires are, how they're growing, is astonishing.
Well, thank God for him. I'm glad someone is trying to manage this situation, because, and you experienced this too. So when I did get to the Holiday Inn, I then got two evacuation notices that were fake from the city, essentially.
Right. There's always that joke that it's an intern, like some intern's about to get fired. But we learned in a press conference that there is no one person who pressed the wrong button and sent this out. They don't know how it happened.
Which is like, can there be a human being overseeing this process before they send Amber Alerts, not Amber Alerts, but you know what I mean, to like half of Los Angeles?
Absolutely. Well, we should say that you did actually end up at the same hotel in Long Beach that I was at.
Yeah. Well, I was like, I have to get out of this Holiday Inn. I'm just going to go home and do a better job of packing and wait there until I get like the full evacuation warning. Then the Palisades fire started moving towards Brentwood. Brentwood got evacuated, and there is basically like an evacuation warning that was like maybe like four blocks away from my house. And where I live is in a very like wooded area. I live off of a windy two-lane street. It's really not the place you would want to be stuck in the event of a fire or an evacuation. So I was like, fuck it, I'm joining Lauren in Long Beach. Although that time I did a better job of packing because I had a few hours at home, and I did rescue our Smith Jared poster. Guys, you don't know about this, but maybe like 3 years ago, 4 years ago, Lord and I bought this massive poster of Smith Jared, and it's the absolute hunk ad, but we are going to frame it and hang it in our new office. And yeah, I felt good about saving that. But I'm glad that our stays overlapped that one night. And then you and Paul went back to your house and I went to Joshua Tree, where I am now.
That's right, guys. I don't know if you can tell, but we are recording remotely. And if you couldn't tell until we told you, then hallelujah, because we've been trying to figure out how to record remotely since we began the podcast.
Well, it's hard also when you're at the mercy of an Airbnb and Joshua Tree's Wi-Fi. Like, you really never know. But this Airbnb came through. But I just love it so much out here. This is also where I came in the beginning of the pandemic. So I guess this is just my, like, apocalypse refuge.
I have never watched so much local news in my life. At a certain point, it felt like they were making up newscasters. Like, I feel like if you and I had gone down to KTLA, we could have gone on air.
Okay, but one thing I've learned is that, like, a lot of our newscasters are really, really hot. Like, I am obsessed with Courtney from KTLA. She's kind of giving Vanna White. She's kind of giving Selling Sunset, like Mar-a-Lago, but I'm into it.
Oh, they all have the same look. It feels like they were made in a factory.
Can we also talk about the lesbian fire chiefs? Because I don't know if this has really spread outside of Los Angeles so much, but I just want our listeners to know that the three women that are basically running the fire department in Los Angeles are all lesbians, and they're all named Kristen or Christina. I really need a 90s style sitcom about these women's lives and like all of their partners. And I really think it could be called like Kristen, Kristen, and Christine. It's kind of giving like Zoe Duncan, Jack and Jane energy.
The Daily Show on Monday with Jon Stewart hosting did a great bit about this and pulled Megyn Kelly talking about this very fact. And she's just like so irate. She's like, Kristen, Christina, Christine, lesbian, lesbian, lesbian. And frankly, I think that's maybe what the sitcom could be called.
Yeah, that would be good too.
Never did I think that the most sane voice in this media storm would be Jason Oppenheim, one of the Oppenheim brothers from Selling Sunset. I'm not even joking.
What did he say?
He's been on CNBC for like 5 days straight. He was the first person to raise the flag about price gouging with rent. He's working with the DA to stop landlords from doing that. He's been monitoring the MLS and reporting on price gouging. He's offered his services for free.
I love him. I saw him at Great White the other day.
In this clusterfuck, we've had to find some light. Never leave a good crisis go to waste. And I think Spencer Pratt has taken that to heart, because not since 2006 have I thought about Heidi and Spencer.
Yeah, same. Although I do respect them for their place in culture, and I suppose they are pioneering reality stars in a lot of ways.
All of that appearing on random European reality shows and debasing themselves for Us Weekly photo shoots led to them buying this home in the Palisades that burned down.
And now Spencer Pratt is making like the best TikTok content, and I guess I'm obsessed with him now. Like, how did that happen? I think it's fucked up how cruel people have been to them. Like, oh, they're rich, they'll rebuild, you know, whatever. And I think that people are really overestimating the wealth of certain celebrities.
A lot of people's net worths are tied to their homes.
For sure. I don't know if you've ever seen photos of Heidi and Spencer's house before it burnt down, but they have these massive, like, Martin Scholler portraits of themselves, like macro portraits of themselves in that house. And I'm sad that those are gone. Oh my God. Sorry, Tat just said that Martin Scholler is reprinting them for Heidi and Spencer and giving it to them.
This is also going to have unintended consequences to the Los Angeles economy. I mean, it's already reverberating. I saw a TikTok of a woman who's a server who's like, look, we live on tips, and I work at a hotspot that is always packed, even on a weekday night, and we're half filled. It might seem cavalier and silly to be going out to restaurants at this time, but life needs to carry on, or I think it's going to be even more devastating.
It's so true.
Speaking of which, have you seen the rumors that we might not be having the Oscars this year?
I have. No one loves the Oscars more than people that live in Los Angeles. Don't take that from us as well. We've already had to deal with the postponement of whatever the fuck Beyonce was going to announce. What I hope they don't do is decide to hold it in some random train station like they did in the pandemic.
Oh God, that COVID year where the producers were so convinced that Chadwick Boseman was going to win a posthumous Oscar, that for the first time ever, they moved the best actor to the last award of the night, and he didn't win. Anthony Hopkins won, and he wasn't even there.
Yeah, that was bad.
Well, I'm sure people would love for us to move on and talk about something else, but I do want to touch down on something personal that's happening to you because you've been going through it yourself. Obviously, there are other things going on in the world, but I want to check in on how you're personally feeling.
Sure. So basically, guys, that horrible stomach virus that I had on the plane coming back from Australia, I never really recovered from that. My body never recovered. My stomach has been upset for like weeks now, basically. And I've been trying to do everything I can to fix it. So first I went on the Brat diet, which is the opposite of Charlie XCX's definition of Brat. The Brat diet is an acronym for bananas, rice, applesauce, and toast. And that's what I was eating like when I was in the Holiday Inn. That was awful, honestly, and it didn't work. It actually got worse after the Brat diet. So now basically, Tat's been like cooking all this food for me. Now I'm basically just not eating processed foods, and I'm eating very small quantities of food. I can't drink coffee. I can't drink alcohol. And having to go on like an involuntary like crash diet slash dry January during this anxiety-inducing catastrophe has been just not my favorite.
You're sort of non-consensually in your Goop era. Have you even been able to have your beloved Diet Coke?
I can't have anything carbonated. I literally just drink water and tea.
And guys, you have to understand, for Chelsea, there's nothing worse to her than actual water.
Yeah, I know. I hate drinking water.
Lest you guys think that we are complete vapid bitches, we do want to give back to our community. And Chelsea, would you like to tell the fuckats what we plan to do?
If you buy anything from our store this week, any Every Outfit merch, 100% of the proceeds will be split between two really wonderful nonprofits. Firstly, the Anti-Recidivism Coalition's Firefighter Fund. This supports the immediate needs for the incarcerated firefighters that are saving our city, gives them meals, hygiene supplies, clothing, and equipment, as well as scholarship funds for when they are released. We will also be supporting Pasadena Humane, which is an animal shelter that has rescued hundreds of animals from the Eaton Fire. A lot of these animals have injuries. They're animals that were either lost during the fire or perhaps left behind by their owners. So we want to do everything that we can to make sure they return to loving homes. So now is the time to buy merch. If you've had your eye on anything, we have fuckat hats. We have J'adore Dykes tees. We even have some Don't Hate Me tees left over from our Australian tour. So do your thing.
Okay. Shall we get back to our regularly scheduled bullshittery? We have some Sex and the City news.
Lay it on me.
So the Are You a Charlotte podcast premiered. Did you listen to the episode?
Of course. I listened on my drive to J-Tree. This is Kristen Davis's new podcast. It is about Sex and the City, as you can imagine. And it's a solo podcast, or at least the first episode is. I think she's going to have more guests on in the future. But the first episode is basically her just talking about auditioning for and shooting the pilot episode.
Yeah, and again, with our monotone voices, I hope this does not come off insincere. I mean this quite genuinely. Doing a solo podcast is not for the weak. I could never do a solo podcast. I need someone's energy to bounce off of. So kudos to her for just monologuing for an hour. And a lot of very interesting anecdotes in this first episode.
Yeah, I loved how she revealed that Carrie was initially described to her as someone with the body of Heather Locklear and the mind of Dorothy Parker, which describes Candace Bushnell to a T.
It's especially funny when you think about the fact that Darren Star wrote the pilot, Darren Star created Melrose Place, Kristen got into a backstory I've always been interested in as someone that knows her as Brooke from Melrose Place, how she went from being this, and I mean this in complimentary, a psychotic bitch on Melrose Place to the character of Charlotte. I always thought Darren Star must have thought of her for Charlotte, but we learn in the podcast that actually he was like, you should audition for Carrie. And she read the role and she read that description. She went, that's not me. What about this Charlotte person over here?
I also love that she described how fucked up the contracts were. Like, basically, when she was shooting the pilot, they were like, okay, and now you have to agree to do this show for the next 7 years at this, I assume, extremely fucked up rate.
When they were shooting the pilot, someone knocked on her trailer and it was a new contract that said you would be working for $5,000 an episode. She also discusses, which I've always wondered about, Charlotte's bob that she has in the pilot episode that she would never have again. As we learn, inspired by Jill Hennessy.
Yeah, they made her cut her hair. But, like, I guess the on-set hairstylist was kind of, like, fucked and she didn't trust him. So she just went to some random salon and that's what they did to her. But I have always wondered why her hair was like that in the pilot.
I do love that Kristen's own approximation of herself as Charlotte compared to the other actresses was that she seems like the only person who doesn't actually live in New York.
Yeah. I can kind of see that, I guess. That was so sad, though, that part where she started crying talking about Willie Garson.
Willie was the first person that she saw in the audition room. And it seemed like quite a grueling audition. She and Willie Garson essentially sat there all day while they waited to test, watched other people who were testing for their roles go in, come back out, retest. And the note that she kept getting was, you need to be funnier.
But she was doing, like, the scene on the Met steps with the guy, right? Like, that's not even a funny scene.
Yeah, I mean, what is she supposed to throw in, a wacky face?
Anyway, congrats to Kristen on the pod. We will be listening.
Another thing that popped up on our feeds that has been an endless source of fascination to us for years is what we'll now call Carrie Brownstone Gate. And this has to do with the people that own the brownstone that they shoot as Carrie's exterior. I believe on our last Hotline episode, we discussed the gossip that someone gave to us that the people that own this brownstone basically said to the production, you cannot shoot here anymore, which is would explain why Carrie moved out of her brownstone to move back in, to move back out again. It seems that they are now petitioning the city to be able to put a wrought iron gate at the steps of their brownstone to stop people from coming and taking photos. And as they say, carving their initials into their wooden doors.
So fucked up. So the woman that lives there's name is Barbara Lorber. And she, I guess, made an in-person appeal to the New York City Landmarks Preservation Commission to get this gate built. She also wrote a letter to them basically explaining the situation and why she needs this wrought iron gate on her house. And I did not realize that this woman has lived there since before Sex and the City. And in this letter, she says that the only reason why she allowed Sex and the City to be filmed there to begin with is because a location scout who is a recent graduate from NYU basically came to her and was like, if I cannot secure this location, I'm going to lose my job. So she felt sorry for him, said yes, of course, not knowing how popular Sex and the City would become and the fact that she would be haunted by this decision for decades to come. And now I feel horrible for her because we always assumed that someone bought it afterwards.
I love that she has to give context to how popular the show is, which should tell you how draconian, I guess, West Village housing laws are, because she goes on to say, like, this is a worldwide phenomenon. It has been translated in 34 languages.
I can't even imagine the shit that she sees. And honestly, if I couldn't, like, walk to my door with my like Trader Joe's groceries without like some bitch like making TikToks on my stairs, I would go crazy too.
I do enjoy that she spells TikTok like tic-tac-toe with a C instead of a K.
I feel like Max should just make her an offer that she can't refuse and end this once and for all. The property would be extremely valuable anyway. It has to be more valuable because of Sex and the City. And you would think that maybe just some celebrity would want to buy it, but obviously they wouldn't want the fans that come with it.
We've seen and we've discussed on the podcast during the day how many people come by and take photos. But in her letter, what I didn't realize is after dark, when people have had a few drinks, because there is a chain up that people just climb over that chain. They try to get into the house. They ring doorbells. They knock on the door. I mean, it's a straight up horror film once the sun goes down.
Yeah, what a nightmare.
I hope this woman gets her gate.
They did approve the gate, but not the initial design. They opposed some sort of arch that was part of the design. Anyway, what else? We have some hotline calls.
We do have some hotline calls. Speaking of Sex and the City, we got this call, Jill.
Hi, Lauren and Chelsea. I always wondered why Sex and the City chose to kind of ignore the events of 9/11, which I know is a very, obviously, dark event, but then chose to head-on address the COVID-19 pandemic. It felt like they thought they had to somehow for some reason in Dressed Like That, but they really ignored 9/11. Just sort of wondering what your thoughts on that may be, and it always struck me as odd. All right, love you, ladies. Love the podcast.
My guess is that they didn't address 9/11 on Sex and the City because it was simply too depressing. And I don't think they were interested in making a show that really tackled the unique horrors of being a New Yorker in 2001.
The irony of the season finale of season 4, I Heart NY, is that it feels like it's a nod to the events of September 11th, but it was actually written, shot, and in the editing phase when the attacks happened. It's just this bizarre parallel. Knowing that if they had dealt with the events of 9/11, it would have been in season 5. And that season was dark enough.
They didn't directly acknowledge it, but the one sort of passing acknowledgement was in the episode where Samantha and Carrie go to San Francisco, where Carrie says, I don't like the TSA, like, going through my bags.
It wasn't just Sex and the City. Friends did this as well. It was a very interesting kind of silent decision made by many television shows that they were not going to do a, you know, a very special episode that dealt with the events of 9/11, but there were nods in subtle ways, right? Joey wears an FDNY hat in one of the Friends episodes. But the other part of this question is, like, why did they ignore 9/11 and why did they deal with COVID? I think because And Just Like That came out in 2021, that it was so recent after the pandemic, they had no choice but to acknowledge it. But I think if the show had premiered in 2022, they would have just glossed over it. Because I think as a culture, we don't want that. I don't want COVID acknowledged in my media.
No, but also, And Just Like That has an opposite thought process of Sex and the City because they do want to tackle hard issues. They don't want to create a show that is an escapist fantasy. But it's hard because they kind of want to toe the line between those two worlds, right? And that's the tension of the series. We get Carrie going to the Met Gala, and on the other hand, we have Big dying, LTW's miscarriage, Aiden's crazy ass son eating too many magic mushrooms, that kind of stuff.
Hey, Slut, it's Mary here. I was just thinking as I listened to your Sex and the City movie recap podcast, do you think Mr. Big knows Jeffrey Epstein? I mean, he must, right? All right, thanks.
Of course, Mr. Big knows Jeffrey Epstein. I don't think he's gone to the island. But more alarmingly, I think that Samantha might be friends with Ghislaine Maxwell.
Oh, well, I have a theory. I think Annabelle Bronstein is the alias of Ghislaine Maxwell.
Could be. Look, I think that Big is ultimately a moral person. But when you have the job that he does, you have to meet some pretty sinister characters. That's just part of it.
Big goes where the business is. Carrie's like, wait, how do you know Bill Gates, John?
You know, that would really complicate Carrie's like grief recovery. It's like if Big is named as like one of the people on Epstein's jet, like after his death. And she thought the Pinkberry punch card was confusing.
So I'm watching Friends and I can't help but wonder, who do you think the four girls would date in the Friends world? Because ideally, they're in New York the same time Sex and the City is going on. They're a little bit younger, but I wonder if it would ever cross over. I know Kristen Davis was on and dated Joey and was like a psycho about it. But yeah, just wondering your thoughts.
There are four girls and three guys. But I think we could safely say it's Samantha and Joey, right? Joey is absolutely Samantha's type. I know the show's existing at the same time. I can tell you, Samantha smashed Joey.
Oh, for sure. The underemployed actor thing would be a little bit of a turnoff, but not enough to stop her, because that's basically Smith Jarrett also, right? On Sex and the City. Also, I'm going to say Chandler and Charlotte. Because Charlotte is not unlike Monica, and Chandler and Miranda would be way too much. Also, Chandler and Carrie would have that like really sick, like burger Carrie dynamic that we want to avoid.
Here's my pitch for Chandler and Carrie, because Chandler did date Janice and he married Monica, so he can handle a high maintenance woman. We don't know Chandler's job for most of the show. He too is a vague finance guy like Mr. Big.
I think Chandler and Charlotte could be good for each other because he is so pessimistic and she is so optimistic.
See, I had Charlotte and Ross.
No, Lauren. It's Ross and Miranda. Think about it.
Really?
Like Steve, Ross is a good, kind of nerdy guy. Also, Ross already married a lesbian before. So it makes sense that he would be into Miranda because he's like into that kind of woman. And some guys just are. I think that would be very sweet if Miranda and Ross dated. In my version of this sort of Jetsons meets the Flintstones dating situation, I think Carrie is the odd one out.
My initial impulse was I could see Carrie dating. Remember when Bruce Willis guest starred because he was the father of Ross's college-age girlfriend?
Yes.
I could see Carrie dating him.
Or Tom Selleck. Didn't he date Monica for a minute?
Indeed, indeed. Yes, he's given Mr. Big vibes.
Guys, I'm just here lying in bed and I decided to call in and ask you, what do you think about Nara Smith?
This is one of the better voicemails we've ever gotten, I think, for its humor and its brevity.
Thank you, caller, for doing your voicemail in Nara Smith's voice. At least I hope you're trying to do a Nara Smith voice.
Guys, if you don't know who Nara Smith is, this woman wasn't just impersonating Lauren and I. There is someone with an even spookier voice out there, and her name is Nara Smith.
But Chell, that voice that she does in her TikTok videos is a total put on, because there's a Harper's Bazaar video with her actual voice, and I wouldn't say it's wildly different, but she does code switch in a Paris Hilton way.
For sure. It's giving Elizabeth Holmes.
I love the shtick because it's performance art, and people don't really get that because no one is realistically making their own sunscreen or cereal from scratch.
I love it. I'm not like the biggest stan. I'm not consuming all of her content, but I have definitely been mesmerized by it. I love that her voice sounds like Lurch from the Addams Family, but she looks like, I mean, she's absolutely gorgeous. I love the way that she dresses, although it stresses me out to see her like cooking pasta in some like satin Rodarte slip dress or something.
If you've been living under a rock and you don't know who Nara Smith is, she is a model who cosplays as a trad wife, but she's really a content creator. But the idea is all of her videos are these elaborate how to make food or home objects like sunscreen, but you would never do it. It's not like she publishes these recipes and they all take 6 hours.
Yeah.
So she's married to the model Lucky Blue Smith. And I saw this tweet and I now can't unsee this. The tweet said her and her husband look like 1940s nuclear test dummies.
Not wrong.
And I now can't unsee this.
They're cool. I'm into them.
Okay. Next call.
Hi. Big fan of the show and long-term listener, caller, etc. I have a question for you. So I listened to your Chloe 70 episode. I read the profile. I followed her for a long time. And then I was at a party last night and she was there with her husband. And it was at this ridiculous apartment filled with Duchamps and Princes and Judds, or at least one of each. And I found that I had nothing to say to Chloe. I didn't talk to her. We smiled at each other. But I was wondering, if you were at a party with Chloe 70, if any of the fuckheads are, what do you think is a good sort of way into the conversation with her or something to ask her? Because I know so much about her, and yet I had nothing to say. Thanks. Bye.
I, too, have seen Chloe 70 at various parties over the years, and I never, ever talked to her. I know too much about her. I would feel like a stalker. And I don't usually talk to celebrities unless I'm introduced to them or I'm like in a situation with them. Like they're sitting next to me at a restaurant or we're in an elevator or a line or something.
Yeah, there is something to knowing too much about someone that the pendulum actually swings the other way and it just makes it impossible to ever have a conversation with them.
But if you were to have a conversation with Chloe 70, I guess I'd try and talk to her about something a bit more obscure. Like maybe some of the short films that she's directed, which we've actually seen.
I started to think of prompts, but everything I came up with sounded so dumb. I mean, this fuckette talks about this fabulous apartment that had Duchamps and Donald Judds in them. So maybe I would have approached and been like, do you think this Donald Judd is real? Did you hear about the Judd Foundation suing Kim Kardashian for having a fake Donald Judd table?
Oh, that's good. I like that, Lauren. What I really want to talk to her about, I'm like, what are like the last 50 things you've bought? Just tell me, or better yet, make a spreadsheet with links.
Which, by the way, I'm sure is the last thing she wants to talk about.
Hi, Lauren, Chelsea, longtime listener, also hot, rich. Like a random question for you. I know it comes up quite often on the pod. We talk about your fun celebrity sightings at random hotspots in LA, membership clubs and things. I'm super curious where you stand on membership clubs in general. I feel like more and more are popping up every year. Are they outdated? Are we channeling our Annabelle Bronstein this summer and joining anything? Interested to know what you think, because you both are very chic and you have good days.
So I edited this call down, but the caller references the San Vicente Bungalows, which is opening in New York, how she was a member of Soho House, but that isn't the vibe anymore. And, you know, Chell, there's been a lot of talk of losing the third place, places for people to socialize that aren't bars and restaurants. And it makes sense that in our late stage capitalist society, third places have become expensive members only clubs.
My thought is, why not? If people want to join these clubs, they can. Also, a lot of people I know that are members of Soho House presently, they more use it as a co-working space. That's also a big function of some of these spaces, not all. Like, you wouldn't really go to San Vicente Bungalows to work. Maybe you'd have a coffee and sit on your laptop for a minute, but it's not really set up for that sort of thing. Whereas like I was a member of the Wing, and while that was a members only club, it was more of a co-working space. So I think for independent contractors, since so many of us are now, it makes more sense than ever.
Where would you join?
I don't know. Like, I like San Vicente Bungalows. I have friends that are members, but you're basically a member to go to a restaurant. Although I see how these clubs can really be about networking. And I think that San Vicente Bungalows, also known as SVB, is an example of that. But there's also the Justin Bieber one, the, what is it called? The Bird Streets?
It's on Sunset. It doesn't look very good. It's just, it's up the street from Prince Street Pizza.
Actually, that one I've never been to. And if anyone listening is a member, can you take us? I want to see it. I want to see Justin Bieber.
Well, I love how this fuckhead is like, you guys are cool. You're in the know. We don't actually belong to any of these members only clubs.
I also love the fact that a lot of these clubs, they really want their members to have privacy. So the whole thing is you can't take photos in there, which I think is nice. It's nice to be in an environment where people aren't constantly photographing shit, especially in LA. Okay, next question was actually submitted via Instagram DMs, but I'm very excited to talk about this. Thoughts on Jeremiah Brent on the new season of Queer Eye? Lauren?
Love him. I mean, I've loved him since the Rachel Zoe days, when he started as Rachel Zoe's stylist, but had a passion for interior design and redecorated her home while she was having her first or second child.
See, I completely forget him from the Rachel Zoe era. I think I only watched the first couple of seasons of that show. Honestly, that show like stressed me out. I think when it was first on, I need to revisit it, I think. But I think he's a genius addition to the cast. He actually makes more sense than Bobby within this particular group of people. Bobby's energy was not of the sort of like extroverted, like insta-gay variety. Whereas Jeremiah, I feel like, can more like fit in with them.
He is of reality television. And then he married a fellow TV interior designer gay in Nate Berkus.
Oh, wait, what? He married Nate Berkus?
Yes.
I had no idea. God, I was just thinking about Nate Berkus because it was like the 25th anniversary of like that horrible tsunami where he lost his previous partner.
The 20th anniversary, but yes.
Okay, 20th anniversary. I'm sorry. I read all about it in that issue of People with JonBenet Ramsey on the cover that I had bought at the airport.
Well, they've been married since 2014. They have two children and fabulous homes.
That's really, really cute. And honestly, I am so grateful to the Fab Five this week because like this is the only show that like doesn't make me feel like shit. I'm sure there are gay male listeners of ours that maybe don't feel the same way or might be a little bit triggered by it, but like I don't know. I think it's really wholesome. I do wish Tan France was better at dressing people though. He has like one of the best personalities, I think.
Right.
But like some of the outfits he puts people in, I'm like, how?
I did enjoy the first episode, which deals with a woman who was a showgirl, that he actually designed pieces for her.
Yeah. No, that was cool. But yeah, I would recommend this season. Also, Dita Von Teese is in the first episode of this season, most importantly.
Yes, the Jubilee Theater, where we saw her perform last May, plays a prominent role in the first episode.
Also, the Fab Five, like, I don't think they actually stayed there, but they certainly shot parts of this episode in the crazy, like, I think Caesar's Palace suite that was in Enora.
Right, yes.
So yeah, go off, Jeremiah. Love you.
You're going to go down a total rabbit hole now that you know that he's married to Nate Berkus. You must have missed their Architectural Digest cover together.
Oh, he was that guy. Okay. Yes. I knew of him separately, like as an interior designer, not because of Rachel Zoe, but because he's one of those random interior designers that I just follow on Instagram for whatever reason.
Hey guys, this is Lauren and Oklahoma City. I just read your polyester interview and you guys talked about men's fashion and I was just wanting to know, who do you think are considered the most stylish men? Anyway, bye.
You go.
Yeah, my mind goes a little blank. I don't remember us talking about male fashion in our polyester interview, but the first person that comes to mind, if we're talking about contemporary style and like with women's fashion, everyone has a stylist, so it's never been easier to look good and look like you have style. But I think someone that genuinely has excellent personal style is Donald Glover.
For sure.
I think he's someone that takes risks. He has a point of view. And I mean, everyone else that I thought of, like there's a lot of guys that look good. Oscar Isaacs, Austin Butler, Timothée Chalamet. But they all have stylists.
Yeah, Jacob Elordi also beat in that category. Although I think he's probably the best of that group. My first thought when I heard this question was Mickey Rourke. He has his own sense of style. Like, he has a very specific silhouette. And it's definitely not inspired by anything that is happening in fashion today. It's his own look that he's cultivated over the years, and I respect him for that. It's also very Los Angeles. But I think that the most stylish men are all fashion designers. I think that Stefano Pilotti has amazing style. I follow him on Instagram, and I always love what he wears.
Where is he now?
I think he had his own line for a minute, but I don't know if that's still happening. But he does post cute fit pics. I also like Rick Owens because he has a uniform that he also designed, which I feel like is the most amazing thing. And, of course, Marc Jacobs. He isn't someone like Rick Owens who's like created his own personal uniform for himself. He's clearly such a fan of fashion and other designers' work. And I love how eclectic his fashion sense is. I love that he's wearing like Chanel women's suits and then like bespoke Huntsman suits and Balenciaga. And he's always been so obsessed with Prada. And I think that's cool. We never know what to expect from Marc. Also, that time he wore Comme des Garçons to the Met Gala, like that lace dress. That was one of the best Met Gala looks ever, I think.
Do you still maintain that a man has never looked better than Jason Segel in I Love You, Man?
I do. Jason Segel, specifically the part where he wears shorts and Uggs on the beach when he's walking his dog, I maintain. I do think that he has incredible style. I love guys that sort of dress in a stonerish way. That also applies to like a Al Pacino Serpico, which how has this come up twice in like this month? I don't remember what the context was last time. Oh, Blake Lively, right. Blake Lively's insane outfits.
And Al Pacino is someone that definitely drums to the beat of his own drum when it comes to personal style, if you've ever seen him out and about.
I think it's marches to the beat of his own drum.
Thank you. As he was coming out, I was like, that doesn't seem correct.
Hi, y'all. My name is Dana. I'm calling from New York. I've been waiting for an answer to this question for the entire time I've been listening to you guys, which has been like over a year, and it hasn't come, so I'm just going to call and ask myself, but how did you guys meet? Like, what's the love story there? Was it like you were instantly friends? Did you like each other at first? What were your first impressions? I feel like I've been waiting for this story forever, so this is me asking for it. Okay, bye.
Chelsea and I have been hesitating to tell this story because we are actually podcast industry plants. We didn't know each other until some iHeartRadio executives brought us in for a chemistry read about 5 years ago.
The topic was Nicole Kidman, and just everything was perfect from then on.
No. We discussed this a while ago, but I suppose we have a bunch of new listeners who do not know this lore.
Yeah, we met in college. I was a senior. Lauren was a junior. We went to Parsons, and we were both in this like weird interdisciplinary department, and we met in like the student lounge.
Yes, I think I was a sophomore. We hung out a bunch because you graduated and then you came back and would be in the research library. But I had seen Chelsea from afar at this time. I mean, Chelsea's a very striking person that you wouldn't forget, but especially at this time, you had quite the silhouette. You had the platinum bob, the bangs, a leopard coat. And so I had seen Chelsea prior to us ever speaking. Chelsea was like my Chloe 70. I was just like, how do I start a conversation with this cool person? Because I looked at you and I was like, oh, I need to be friends with this person. And my moment came when you were explaining the idea of camp through the film Showgirls to someone in the lounge. And I was like, this is my time. I got to jump in.
It is truly insane that that's the first thing that we ever talked about.
Where our lives ended up. Absolutely. But I think an important part of our story is that we were friends. We were friendly, but we were basically acquaintances. because I moved back to Los Angeles and I would see you periodically, and you started coming out to Los Angeles more, and we started the Instagram account as a joke. And then in 2016, an odd confluence of events happened where we started the Instagram. You went through a breakup. I said, why don't you come out and stay here for a couple of weeks? You kind of didn't leave, and now we're besties.
Okay, to be fair, you invited me to stay.
I did invite you to stay, and because you had no social network, you had no choice but to hang out with me, which really, under a different lens, I'm realizing this could sound like a low-key version of Misery.
But yeah, it's true that we weren't super close until we started the account, I guess. We would see each other. We'd go to movies and stuff. Like, I remember we saw Scream 4 together.
That we did.
It was really the account and then me moving to LA that brought us closer. And look at us now.
So I'm here to say you can trick your acquaintance into becoming your bestie if you start a successful social media account with her.
And have a spare room in your house.
So yeah, that's how we became friends.
All right, speaking of houses.
Hi, Lauren and Chelsea. My name's Emily. I'm a New York fuckette calling, looking for some decorating advice. I'm in grad school and I work full-time in healthcare, but I have the opportunity when my current lease is up to live for free in a rent-controlled apartment on the Upper East Side. It belongs to a family friend. But it hasn't been updated since the 80s. It's kind of crusty and dilapidated, has slanted floors, and does not have any closets for some reason. What can I do to unfuck this apartment while I live there for a year or two and pay off my student loans? Thanks so much for the advice. Love the show. Bye.
Okay, I wish I had pics. Also, I wish I understood, like, is this apartment completely furnished? Can you give it a fresh coat of paint? Because that's obviously number one, especially if you're living in a musty, dusty, you know, maybe has popcorn ceilings or those horrible tit-shaped lights that, like, cheap landlords use, you know?
Yeah, I mean, there are some things like the slanted floors that I don't even think Aiden Shaw would be able to fix in this rental.
No, and that's fine. And you have to lean into that. Like, lean into the fact that you have a funky New York apartment. Don't try and hide that. My main concern is the fact that you have no closets. You are going to have to find storage solutions. And because you describe this apartment as 80s, I would maybe like lean into that instead of fighting it. And you can get like pretty cheap like laminate dressers from the 80s at vintage stores or like on Etsy or on Facebook Marketplace or whatever the fuck. You also could just get an industrial garment rack from Uline. You know I love Uline, despite the fact that the people that own it are very sinister.
I think I can hear Big in the background, by the way.
Oh, I'm sorry if you guys can hear the bulldog snores. Really? Okay, I'm going to wake him up.
Come on, wake up. Yeah, good boy. He's awake.
Okay. Yeah, I had an apartment in my 20s that didn't have adequate closet space, so I just kind of put my best shit on a garment rack, on an industrial rack, and just kind of tried to style it nicely so things of similar colors and lengths were grouped together.
Yeah, and I feel like since we've lived in New York, the peel and stick tiles have really come up in a way that didn't exist for us. Like, you could completely resurface an apartment in a very apartment-friendly or renter-friendly way. There's a lot of great renter-friendly options. Like, I think there are these chic canvas covers for the tit lights now that you could just put over them.
Also, just changing the light fixtures, you know, you can change them when you move. Sometimes that is really, really worth it. And as always, I do think that it's good to like invest in one thing, like have one thing be major, and then everything else can just be sort of more minimal and stripped back. Like, if you have a really major bed or a really major couch or a really major, like, massive work of art or something, one piece that does a lot, I think, is always good.
And depending on when you move, you can really make out on Facebook Marketplace. I mean, that is the one nice thing about living in a ritzy city, is you can get a lot of fancy stuff from people who are just like, I'm moving. Take this off my hands today.
Yeah, but you will have to make like Facebook Marketplace a part-time job for like a week or two where you're constantly refreshing because people are just like so fast. Like I put an outdoor couch up there that was free, I don't know, a few months ago, and I got 10,000 responses within a minute.
Send us photos.
Yes, yeah, send us photos, please. Send it to our email.
Hello. Okay. I'm calling because I am interested if either of you have read / watched the movie that was made, Once Is Not Enough, by Jacqueline Suzanne, the novel that she wrote after Valley of the Dolls. I would argue that it's better, I think, book-wise and maybe even film-wise, because the narrative is a little easier to follow, but it still has all the camp elements of a Jacqueline Suzanne novel / movie made out of novel. There is a psychosexual sort of plot line between a dad and the daughter, which I think Lauren would love. There's an unhinged magazine editor who I think Chelsea would love. There are twists and turns and plane crashes, and it's truly insane. And the film, while bad, has some really funny parts. So I'm wondering if you all have seen it and would discuss it. Okay, bye.
Okay, I have read the book, Once Is Not Enough, but I have never seen the film. I would love to see the film. But I read the book such a long time ago. Like I was literally in middle school when I discovered Jacqueline Suzanne. I think I was in eighth grade and I have this vivid memory of seeing the paperback for Valley of the Dolls at the Chicago airport. And I became obsessed with that book. And then I read all of her other books, but it was such a long time ago that they all like bleed together for me. But the cover of the Valley of the Dolls book from the 90s is the same shade of pink that we use in our branding today.
Ooh. Yeah. Should we make this part of the VIP book club?
Oh, for sure. I want to reread Valley of the Dolls. Also, I've heard that there's a new audiobook version that Laverne Cox reads that's supposed to be amazing. So I feel like it's probably good to like listen to the audiobook.
I do love how this fuckhead is like, well, there's a psychosexual relationship between a father and daughter, so Lauren would be into this book.
There is. It has some things in common with Baby Girl. It's twisted. I mean, Jacqueline Suzanne was fucked up, and that's why we love her. Also, at some point, my Jacqueline Suzanne obsession intersected with my Bette Midler obsession because there was a Bette Midler movie where she did play Jacqueline Suzanne, which was quite bad. But I think that people should revisit her. I feel like we need another biopic about her because that one just didn't do it for me.
At the very least, I'm sure a Ryan Murphy miniseries where Naomi Watts plays Jacqueline Suzanne. All right, next call.
Hey, Chelsea and Lauren. Question. I've been hosting these clothing exchanges where friends come over and bring clothes that they don't necessarily want to give away but want to find a new good home for. And I thought in the background I could have iconic fashion moments from TV shows, movies, anything in music videos, the best fashion shows. So I was looking up the winter, like best winter shows, and I just thought of y'all and thought, what would you girls suggest for a playlist of fashion moments in culture, be it music videos, previous runways, or what did I say before, movies? Love you guys. Thanks. Bye.
This is such a broad question. I would advise that you should just play old Thierry Mugler fashion shows from like the late 80s into the mid 90s. Like just Google like Thierry Mugler 1992 and see what happens because his fashion shows were amazing. They're all really long. They're like an hour. But I do think the 20th anniversary one, which was in 1995, was especially good. So I would recommend that. Also, the Yves Saint Laurent World Cup fashion show, also amazing. I feel like you should be playing fashion shows that are like major spectacles if we're doing that. Oh, and like the Margiela Couture show from last year. Play that. Do something contemporary also.
when I was thinking of my favorite fashion shows, I realized they're all 20 years old. Because this Fuckette was also, it seems like she's doing it in the winter time. So I was trying to think of fall winter shows. So I think of Tom Ford's last show for Gucci, fall winter 2004. My favorite, Phoebe Philo, Chloe Collection, the fall winter 2003, which is the rock and roll one. Those are easier to curate as a playlist. It's a little bit harder to find, I assume, on YouTube, fashion shows in television and movies. But one of my favorite cinematic fashion shows that might be a bit of a deeper cut is the fashion show at the end of Don't Tell Mom the Babysitter's Dead.
Because it's not just a fashion show of like gowns and suits and normal stuff. It's like nurses' outfits and like, it's like uniforms.
Yeah, she works for a uniform company, and Christina Applegate is able to revitalize the company by being like, what if uniforms were designed in a Memphis style?
But yeah, I guess we should put together some fashion show playlist at some point, but there's just so many, and there's so many great YouTube channels. There is just a playlist where it's like every Gautier show in chronological order, you know, just put that on, you'll love it.
All right, next call.
Hi, Chelsea and Lauren. This is Vanessa. I cannot wait for you guys to do Fanatical, the Tegan and Sarah catfishing documentary. I just watched it last night. I can't stop thinking about it, and I cannot believe they don't know who did it, and it's been going on for this long. So really hope you guys watch it and discuss it on the show. Thanks. Bye.
Okay, full disclosure, I have never been a Tegan and Sarah fan. I never got it. I never liked their music. I never liked their haircuts. I always thought their fans were annoying. Their fans hate me, by the way. That is one thing I know.
Wait, literally you?
Just like every lesbian that I've ever met that's a Tegan and Sarah fan, it's like we just like do not mesh, as Ty from Clueless once said. But I'm sure the Tegan and Sarah fans that are listening now, you guys are the exception, clearly. But for some reason, I felt compelled to watch this Hulu documentary because I was like, who catfishing? Who's catfishing what? And basically, the story is that in the MySpace era, someone created a fake MySpace account posing as Tegan and then started to have like sort of intimate friendships, in some case, like sexual, you know, not relationships, not in person, of course, but with these random Tegan and Sarah fans that were catfished. And it was especially legit because whoever did this stole like unreleased demos from their manager's private servers. They had like unreleased photos of them. They knew details of their lives that they'd never talked about, like the fact that their mother had cancer, like all of this fucked up shit. And basically they just never figured out who did it. And the person is like still doing it. I watched the whole thing thinking the person would be revealed, but they never are.
I'm sorry. Is this like a Tyler Durden situation where Tegan and or Sarah is actually the catfish, but they can't remember doing it?
I know, right? I mean, also there's this really scary like situation where the fake Tegan like got into like a full relationship, like online relationship with this one lesbian that was like a bit unstable, it seems, that then like could not accept that she had been catfished and started like blasting like the real Tegan on the internet and like in their mutual social circles for like ghosting her, like whatever the fuck it was. Really, really dark.
Well, I did not watch this documentary, but I feel like this is a perfect segue to my micro fixation this week, which is this French woman who was scammed out of more than $800,000 by someone pretending to be Brad Pitt.
Oh yeah, they mentioned that in the Tegan and Sarah documentary. That's how I knew about that.
This person created AI images of Brad Pitt in the hospital and DM'd this woman and convinced her that he needed money for a kidney surgery and he could not pay for it himself because of his divorce with Angelina Jolie. This woman divorced her husband thinking she was going to be with Brad Pitt. And she only realized it was fake when Brad Pitt was on the news with his new girlfriend.
That's so insane.
I was unaware of what Dr. Phil's show was about beyond episodes like the Catch Me Outside girl and the guy that created bum fights that dressed up to look like Dr. Phil. On a week-to-week basis, day-to-day, I don't know what Dr. Phil does in his episodes, but I went down semi-recently a rabbit hole, and he does a lot of episodes about these kinds of love scams. Like, one clip I watched, it was a guy who spent $200,000, and Dr. Phil is talking to him. He's like, "She wrote you this love letter. We went online and found the script." And the guy's like, "I don't believe it. It's just a coincidence." And then Dr. Phil will be like, "Your girlfriend, who you've never met, well, we found the woman in the photos. Jessica is actually Christine. Christine, stand up." And, like, this woman will stand up, and she... And he's like, "Have you ever met this man?" And she'll be like, "No, I'm so sorry this happened to you." And then the guy will just be like, "Don't believe it. Nope."
A lot of people just can't accept the truth about many things in their lives, I suppose. Welcome to Dr. Phil. I mean, he does have his moments. I did, of course, watch the Burke Ramsey interview pretty recently.
Of course. Well, I think that's a great segue to our last call, Chelsea.
Hi, I just listened to the episode about and Chelsea's obsession with the JonBenet Ramsey, and I don't know if y'all have heard, I mean, I feel like you've obviously heard this because of your relation to Katy Perry, but, like, the conspiracy theories about how JonBenet Ramsey is Katy Perry, I know you've heard this, it's just so stupid, you probably didn't, like, mention it on the podcast, but I just thought, that was funny. Okay, love y'all, goodbye.
Obviously true. Just kidding. This is maybe the dumbest conspiracy theory ever. Just because, like, when JonBenet Ramsey died at the age of 6 years old, Katy Perry and myself were both 12. Like, it's not even like they're even remotely the same age.
What is the conspiracy theory? Because I've, of course, heard, oh, Katy Perry's JonBenet Ramsey, but, like, what is the logistics of this? That JonBenet Ramsey was trafficked to a family in Santa Barbara and lived as Kate Hudson, right? That's Katy Perry's name.
Catherine Hudson.
Thank you.
I do not know the intricacies of this particular conspiracy theory. I think it's based on their physical resemblance, which they don't even look like each other. If you have seen an age progression photo of JonBenet Ramsey, she looks nothing like Katy Perry. She looks more like Meghan Trainor or something. Like, she has, like, a very distinctive kind of squarish jawline. Like, the shape of their face is fundamentally different, for one thing. So to me, I don't get it, because it's not even like a close or passable physical resemblance.
Like, a better theory is the one where people found Anton LaVey's daughter on Donahue from the 80s, and she looks exactly like Taylor Swift.
That was impressive. I could be convinced of that, maybe, but definitely, definitely not this.
So we've heard it. We don't believe it. Would be cool. Would be interesting.
Yeah, would be cool, for sure.
But Chell has looked at the age progression photos, and they don't match, guys.
Anyway, that's the end of our calls, but I think before we end this episode, we should acknowledge another bit of tragic Los Angeles news that happened right before we started recording, which was that David Lynch passed away.
I know. How much more can Los Angeles take?
It's so sad. I mean, we've talked in recent episodes about his emphysema diagnosis, which is very sad. It's just surreal. Like his films, I suppose.
It's especially shocking because news came out last week, especially after the Runyon fires, that he was very close to Runyon Canyon and he had been safely evacuated. So I think it was especially shocking when I saw that he had passed away, because it's like, well, he was fine. We just checked in on him last week.
God, what an apocalyptic time for him to go out.
So after we finish recording, Chelsea, I'll drive over to Bob's Big Boy and pour out a cup of coffee in his honor.
Yeah, should we close this episode with the Twin Peaks theme?
Sure.
Why not?
All right. Am I going to see you soon, Chell? Are you coming back from J-Tree?
I'm coming back tomorrow. I'm coming back to work in the Every Outfit Fulfillment Center, because hopefully some of y'all will have bought our merch.
Yes, please. All right, guys, we'll be back next week in person. We think. We hope.
We hope. Bye.
All right, bye.